Eric on their ass. After all, how much more trouble can I get you in? Not much, but let's not talk about that now, Joe said cautiously. Then, maybe we can break everything wide open. If we do that, everything might change. Nate nodded and his smile remained intact. Plus, Joe said, it's the right thing to do. Nate laughed. And just when I was starting to think you were getting more cynical, you come back as Dudley Do-Right after all. It was easier to drive to the highway in their tracks because Nate didn't have to break through the crust of snow. Nate said, "When you step back and look at everything going on around here, it's more than coincidence that three things happened in this little community at the same time. Kate vanished as they were starting to put up the first turbines of the wind energy project. Then the local game warden just vacates his house and no one knows where he is. Have you thought about how that is?"
"Not really," Joe said. "I don't see the connection at all."
"Do you want me to see how I can work the game warden's and Kate's disappearances into my theory?"
Nate asked. "Not really."
"So you think all three events were random, that each has nothing to do with the others?"
"That's what I think."
"We'll see," Nate said, arching his eyebrows in a conspiratorial way.
Nate gathered his fencing pliers to pound the staples back in as they approached the downed fence. He said,
"I'm guessing your talk with Mary Beth will be eventful."
"Yep." But Joe wasn't yet thinking about that. He was recalling the missing files from Pollock's drawer. Was B for Buckbrush? Chapter 23. Joe was pleased to find out that a room had opened up at the Wolf for Nate, who got his keys and went upstairs. Kim Miller handed Joe a Saddle Bronc brown ale. He said, "Thanks, but I didn't order this." "It's on me. I heard you had a rough day." Joe didn't respond. How much did she know? Was the word already on the street that he'd been fired? "I've never actually seen a blow-up sex doll," she said, by way of explanation. "Are they as gross as I think they are?"
"Oh, that," Joe said, relieved. Then, "Yep."
"It doesn't surprise me that McKnight had one of those disgusting things. He never seemed to like real people."
"So you know him," Joe said.
"I'm the bartender," she said with a grin. "I know everybody."
"Of course you do."
"That doll of his looked pretty ridiculous in the picture," she said. "And so does our sheriff."
"The picture?"
Miller swiped at an iPad until the home page for the Daily Dispatch website came up. She handed it over to him. The headlines read, "Cowgirl Kate Folly, Nothing But Hot Air," followed by "Plastic Fantastic, Love in a Cold Climate." Joe winced. The article, which of course had Billy Bloodworth's byline, was written in a campy and derogatory style designed to portray the Carbon County Sheriff's Office in the worst possible light. He referred to the raid as undertaken by countrified Keystone cops. The lead photo was of Sheriff Neal barking out orders while clutching the doll under his arm. The flash from Bloodworth's camera highlighted his fleshy jowls. The flesh-colored vinyl of the doll stood sharply out against the dark background. There was also a shot of Sheridan standing menacingly over the prone figure of McKnight in the snow. Joe was grateful her back was to the camera, so her face wasn't shown. The caption of the photo read, "Cowgirl Tough." This unidentified local female was an eager participant in the Keystone Cops debacle and stands proudly over the injured body of the innocent trapper. Photo by Billy Bloodworth. Nowhere in the story was it mentioned that the reason for the raid in the first place was the photo on Bloodworth's phone, or his claims that he and Sophie had identified the kidnapper and were closing in. The press had its privileges, apparently. Joe was furious. He would have been less angry if it were a photo of him, but his daughter? He considered chasing Bloodworth down on the highway, but the reporter and Sophie had too much of a head start. They were well into Colorado, and Joe not only didn't have jurisdiction, he wasn't sure he officially had a job in law enforcement anymore. And the damage was done. He knew it would be only a matter of time before Hanlon and the governor saw the story and used it for their press conference the next morning. "When I run into this Bloodworth guy, things are going to get real Western," he growled. "Too late," Miller said. "He and Sophie checked out a couple of hours ago. I heard him say they were driving to the Denver airport."
"Tonight?"
"They checked out in a hurry. She was yelling at him for making her pack up in a rush." "And they stiffed us," she said while shaking her head. "The company credit card he gave me was rejected and won't go through."
"Oh, man,"
Joe said. "It's bad," Miller agreed. "That article makes us all look stupid. I don't think Billy likes us very much."
"No," Joe said. "I don't believe he does."
"Your daughter looks fierce, though," she said while jutting out her chin. "She looks like a warrior." Joe handed the iPad back to her, but left the beer on the counter. He told her he'd be back for it in a minute. He climbed into the freezing cab of his truck. Game wardens in Colorado use the same mutual aid radio frequency Wyoming wardens used. He'd met several northern Colorado wardens and found them to be just as hardworking, professional, dedicated, and underpaid as their Wyoming brethren. When the dispatcher responded, Joe said, "This is GF-24. I'd like to request a bolo in southern Wyoming and northern Colorado for a rental vehicle being driven by two suspects." He described Bloodworth's four-wheel drive and gave a brief description of the reporter as well as Sophie. He told the dispatcher the persons of interest were suspected of defrauding an innkeeper and possible other violations. Joe didn't feel very virtuous about his actions as he went up the icy porch steps into the Wolf. But what could they do? Fire him again? He had gathered up his beer and started to mount the stairs when Kim Miller said, "Oh, there's something else I need to tell you. I nearly forgot about it." He paused. "Earlier tonight, someone called and asked if you were staying here, and he asked if he could talk to you. He wouldn't identify himself, and it's our policy not to give out that kind of information."
"Thanks."
I could hear lots of voices in the background and glasses clinking together. I think he was calling from a bar. I do know what a bar sounds like, you know.
"Any idea who it was?" Joe asked.
"I would swear it was Steve Pollock." I said, "Steve, is that you?" He just got real quiet. Then I said, "Steve, this is Kim. I recognize your voice." And he hung up.
"Did he leave a callback number?"
"No."
Joe said, "Why would he call here and not on my cell phone?"
"Maybe so you won't be able to track him down," she said. "He used to come in here all the time. He knows our phones don't have caller ID. In room 9, it took nearly a half hour for Joe to recount all the events of the day to Mary Beth. She was aware of Sheridan's involvement because she'd talked to her daughter earlier, but she was silent when he told her about his call with Hanlon. Then he told her about Nate's theory about Missy being behind it all. Mary Beth responded with a string of curses unlike anything Joe had ever heard from her before.
"She's really crossed the line," Mary Beth said about Missy after she'd calmed down. "I'm absolutely done with her this time. She's gotten so evil and bitter that she doesn't realize how going after you hurts us all. Do you want me to call her out on it?"
"Would it do any good?"
"No, she'd just deny it," Mary Beth said. Then wearily, "What are we going to do?"
He knew she was talking about his job. "I don't have an easy answer." It killed him to admit it. "I'm still a game warden until I get the termination notice in writing from LGD," he said.
"Who knows? Maybe she might not agree with the governor."
"Are you kidding me?" Mary Beth scoffed. "Linda Green Dempsey will do anything to keep her position. Do you really think she'd take some kind of stand on principle?"
He didn't hesitate.
"Nope." "I'll have to sleep on it," she said.
"Not that I'll sleep."
He understood and said so. Joe appreciated the fact that Mary Beth didn't panic, though she had every reason to do exactly that. Together they had maybe 2 months of savings to cover them without his income, and they didn't even have a house to move into. He knew there were grievance procedures for wrongful termination in place within the state personnel system, but he was unfamiliar with them. The very idea of pleading his case before a table of bureaucrats filled him with loathing, and deep down, he wasn't sure he could prove that Hanlon and the governor had set him up to fail, which he absolutely had so far. After a long pause, she said, "So, you're going to just press ahead as if nothing has happened?"
"Yep," thinking, "that's all I know how to do."
"You don't owe those people. Plus, it isn't like we knew Kate and she's important to us. You could just pack up and come home."
"I know that," Joe said.
"But you can't, can you? You're like a dog with a bone. I know you. You won't quit."
He didn't respond. She knew him better than he knew himself.
"In that case," she said, "I do think I'm on to something with Kate, but I can't confirm it 100% yet."
Joe sat up.
She said, "I was able to get into her Facebook timeline even though I'm not her friend and she had privacy settings on."
"How were you able to do that?" Joe asked warily.
"There are ways. I learned this one from Lucy."
Their youngest daughter was adept at using social media, and it came naturally to her. Joe didn't realize she was capable of hacking into a private account, though.
Mary Beth continued, "It appears Kate liked a group called Cowboys Are My Weakness. The group is made up of like-minded women from all over, but most are from the U.S. or U.K. They're cougars, Joe, wealthy women who travel to pursue young cowboys. They have memes like Wrangler butts drive me nuts and that sort of thing. They post photos of cowboys they've been intimate with, or at least they claim they've been intimate with. I think Kate posted a few of the photos, but I can't confirm it yet. If she did, it was under the alias Miss Kitty."
"Miss Kitty?"
he asked.
"Like the Gunsmoke lady?"
"That's right," Mary Beth said, warming to it. "The red-headed one with the beauty mark. Anyway, Miss Kitty liked a lot of the photos posted on the group page. Kate wasn't the most prolific user on the page by any means, but it's obvious she spent time on that site. And she posted a few photos of her own."
"You're good," Joe said with admiration. "This is new. DCI missed that, and so did Billy Bloodworth and the British tabloids."
She said, "Maybe it takes a woman to have a feel for what other women want." He agreed without saying, "I never know what women want." Instead, he asked, "Is there anything on the site about her stay at the Silver Creek Ranch?"
"Yes. I can't confirm Miss Kitty is absolutely Kate,
but there are a few photos posted on the page that correspond to the July dates when Kate was there. I recognize some of the buildings from the Silver Creek Ranch in the background. And there's one photo in particular you'd recognize. I just sent it to your phone while we were talking.
Hold on, Joe said. He activated his email and found it. It was a shot of wranglers saddling up horses in the golden light of early dawn. Sheridan could be seen clearly throwing a saddle on the back of a roan.
See her? Mary Beth said.
Joe didn't respond, because although Sheridan was identifiable, it was obvious the photo wasn't specifically taken of her. She just happened to be there.
Do you see your daughter? Mary Beth asked again.
Yep. In the foreground, pulling on the cinch strap of a saddle, was a young cowboy. Mary Beth hadn't recognized him because she'd never met him before, but Joe had.
The cowboy in the photo is Lance Ramsey, he said. You mean?
That's what I mean. What does Miss Kitty say about Lance? He asked.
She wrote, Yippee-ki-yay,
Mary Beth said glumly. Is that it?
Yes,
but it's clear what she meant.
He said, she must have played that really close to the vest, though.
The GM of the ranch wasn't aware of that, and neither was Sheridan, who has good instincts.
Almost as good as mine, Mary Beth said.
Joe asked, why would she post it unless...
Let's not jump to conclusions, Joe, Mary Beth warned. There might be a good explanation.
Maybe Miss Kitty, I mean Kate, was trying to put one over on the other cougars in the group.
Or maybe not. Either way, Sheridan will need to know at some point.
Joe nodded, even though Mary Beth couldn't see him.
She's not going to like this new development, Mary Beth said.
I don't either,
Joe said. It might break her heart.
I might break his head.
Joe? I'm still researching Richard Cheatham, Mary Beth said. I'm not finding much, and certainly not anything to implicate him.
I'll keep him ranked low on the suspect list, Joe said.
There is something interesting, though. When I did an image search on his name, I found several photos of Richard and Sophie together. The most recent one was of them leaving some kind of formal charity shindig in their finest clothes.
What's interesting about that? He asked.
The photo was from a month ago. Supposedly when Sophie was distraught about finding her missing sister. Doesn't it seem odd that she'd go to a formal event with her ex-brother-in-law?
Didn't he remarry?
Yes, he did. It lasted a few months, and he's back on the market again.
Hmm.
There may be a simple explanation for it, she said. I'll keep digging.
They talked for another 20 minutes until his phone was nearly out of power and he had to sign off, find the charger, and plug it in. He realized he'd forgotten to tell her that Steve Pollock had resurfaced and had inquired about him. Joe lay fully clothed on his bed and stared at the inert ceiling fan. It wasn't spinning like his mind was. He visualized Mary Beth doing exactly the same thing in the townhouse. He wished she were here. Finding out about Miss Kitty framed Kate's disappearance differently, and in a way that he'd really need to think about. Coincidences began to harden into connections under the Miss Kitty light. Sunday morning couldn't come soon enough, he thought. It was a matter of time before his walking papers came through, and he could no longer continue the investigation in an official capacity.
Yippee-ki-yay!
Part 4. The difference between the new managerial elite and the old propertied elite defines the difference between a bourgeois culture that now survives only on the margins of industrial society and the new therapeutic culture of narcissism. Christopher Lash.
Chapter 24. That same hour, Galen Kessel swung his company pickup into the outside lot of the Memorial Hospital of Carbon County on West Elm Street in Rawlins. He drove to the far back row where the overhead lights wouldn't reach, and he backed the vehicle into a slot and killed the headlights, but not the engine. There were fewer than 10 cars in the lot, and Kessel's pickup was the only one in the last row, which was backed by a frozen wall of plowed snow. Ted Panos glanced down at the large envelope that lay on the front seat between them. It had been there since they left Saratoga, but the contents were a mystery to him. Also unexplained was why Kessel had texted Panos to dress in a sports coat and slacks instead of his usual Carhartt overalls and pack boots. The term Kessel used was business casual. Panos had replied, "You're kidding, right?" When Kessel hadn't responded, Panos had closed his eyes and tried to keep his heart from racing. Going out late at night wasn't unusual, but going out business casual certainly was. Something bad was going to happen. Panos had felt it inside when his heart started to race. Before pulling on his too tight dress slacks and brushing a coat of white dust from the shoulders of a suit jacket he'd last worn to a funeral, it still had a folded-up memorial card in the pocket. He riffled through his shaving kit and found the plastic container of bootleg Percocet that had helped him get through similar situations before. He couldn't recall if he was supposed to take 1 or 2 5-milligram tablets, so he swallowed 2 whole and put 2 more in his pocket for later. The medication began to rise through him like an internal blanket of calm even before Kessel arrived in the hotel parking lot. Now Kessel pointed a stubby finger toward the entrance marked emergency.
"That's where you'll go in,"
Kessel said to Panos as he handed him a short-brimmed fedora.
"Put that on and walk in there like you do it every day of your life. Don't go in looking suspicious and sneaky. And don't look up directly at any of the closed-circuit cameras. Keep your head down."
Panos clamped the hat on his head. It fit.
"Do you remember everything I told you on the way here?"
Kessel asked. He asked it in a clipped, disinterested military way. It was Kessel at his most annoying, Panos thought.
"Of course I do."
The second word came out, "Korsh."
"Why are you slurring?"
"I'm not slurring."
Kessel glared at him, and his eyes reflected the distant red light from the emergency sign.
"Ted, you better be clean for this. Have you been drinking?"
"No, sir."
"Are you sure you're okay?"
"Yes, sir."
In fact, Panos felt more relaxed than he had in quite some time. So relaxed that he fought back a wide smile that would only enrage his boss.
"Tell me who you're looking for,"
Kessel asked.
"Carol Schmidt."
"Where will she be?"
Panos had to concentrate to remember what Kessel had told him on the drive there. He'd feigned attention at the time because he was basking in the Percocet calm. It reminded him of a warm bath, but from the inside out, or cloudy pillows floating through his entire body and into his brain. He didn't dare tell Kessel.
"Carol Schmidt will be located in the critical care unit," Panos said. "That unit is located to the right of the reception desk down a hallway."
Kessel continued to stare at Panos as if he could see his thoughts, but he didn't correct him or interrupt. Apparently he'd passed the quiz. What Panos could remember clearly was how in awe of Schmidt Kessel seemed to be. He couldn't believe she'd lasted the night after she went off the road and was transported to Rawlins. He'd called her a tough old bird. and there was something about a head injury, a medically induced coma, and that she may or may not emerge from it with the ability to recall what had happened to her on the highway to encampment. That was why they were there in the parking lot. Carol Schmidt was the reason for business casual. Kessel opened the envelope and handed Panos a lanyard with a plastic Memorial Hospital of Carbon County badge with Panos's driver's license photo on it.
"Whoa, where'd you get this?" Panos asked, meaning the photo.
"I know some people who work here," Kessel said, meaning the hospital. "That's where I got the intel that she's here and where she's located."
Panos didn't follow up on the misunderstanding, because deep in his brain he knew that the more he talked, the greater chance there'd be he would say something foolish or ridiculous. The Percocet was now playing sentimental show tunes in his ears.
"Don't do anything stupid or obvious," Kessel said. "Don't hit her over the head or choke her out, I mean. It's got to look like she passed in her sleep."
"So what do I do?" Panos asked. He was amazed how cool and calm he sounded.
"Size up the situation and make a decision," Kessel said. "Look for machines to shut off or tubes to disconnect. If nothing else, use a pillow. Just don't leave her so anyone suspects anything. Use your best judgment. Got that?"
"Got it," Panos said.
"Remember, you need to walk into that hospital like you've been in there 100 times before. You're a pharmaceutical rep who usually makes calls on docs during the day shift, but you left an important file in one of the offices and you didn't realize it until you got back to your hotel. The receptionist won't know you because she's only there at night. You're there to retrieve your file."
With that, Kessel handed Panos the envelope from the seat of the truck.
"Stick that down the back of your pants so no one sees it when you walk in. Make sure it's in your hand on the way out."
"What's in it?" Panos asked.
"What does that fucking matter?" Kessel asked, his teeth flashing in the red light. "It's a ruse."
"Right," Panos said.
"Her name will be written outside her room on a whiteboard," Kessel said. "Get in and get out. Don't take any longer than it would take to retrieve a file."
"Got it. Then, why am I the one doing this?" Kessel got still. Panos regretted the question immediately. But he was feeling his oats. The drug had flattened his first line of caution.
"Because dead,"
Kessel said, saying each word as if it was a sentence in itself.
"People around here fucking know me. They don't know you. If I went in there, someone would say, 'Hey, I saw him in the newspaper,' or 'Hey, he spoke at my Rotary Club.' Use your fucking brain, Ted," Kessel said. "Now go."
"I didn't sign up for this kind of dirty work, especially against an old woman I don't even know." Kessel lowered his chin slightly, but kept his eyes wide open and probing.
"You signed up to do what's necessary, same as me. I did my part, but somehow she lasted the night. Now it's up to you to finish the job. It's for the greater good," Kessel said. "That old woman could stand in the way of everything. She doesn't know how much she knows, but she recognized me. If she wakes up and starts yammering, it's all over. I explained this to you. Didn't you listen?"
Actually, no, Panos thought. He'd zoned out during that part of Kessel's monologue on the way there. Panos grasped the door handle but didn't yet open it. "Will I get a bonus for this? This is a lot to ask. I better get something."
"You'll get something," Kessel said. "I promise."
Panos wasn't sure he could believe him, but in his medicated state, he wasn't completely sure what he was hearing for certain and what he thought he was hearing. So he let it drop, but he was glad he was numb. He could never do what he was about to do in his right mind.
He opened the door and the cold hit him right away, sobered him up a little, which was good. He fumbled for a minute getting the file into the back of his pants, and it almost got embarrassing. Finally, though, he managed to slide it inside his waistband. He covered it fully when he buttoned his ancient trench coat and walked from Kessel's truck toward the hospital doors. Panos could feel his boss's eyes on his back, so he moved slowly, deliberately. It wouldn't be good if he slipped on ice and fell. He wished the trench coat was lined because it barely kept him warm. But it was the only thing he owned that was business casual.
A woman with a carrot-colored bouffant and glasses looked up from her game of computer solitaire as Panos pushed through the double doors. A sign on the counter in front of her read, Maggie White. He reminded himself that he had been inside the building 100 times, even though he hadn't. "Evening, Maggie," he said with faux familiarity as he flashed his lanyard. "I'm Phil with Pfizer." It was the only pharmaceutical company he could come up with on the fly. "And this afternoon I left a file I need down the hall. It'll just take a minute." He didn't make eye contact with her, just kept moving. "Don't stop and chat." Was it left or right at the counter? He turned on his heel and strode on. To the right. "Sir," she called after him. "Phil?" He kept going. He was suddenly sweating and his vision blurred. Panos made himself slow down, calm down. Maggie White wasn't pursuing him down the hallway, and he didn't hear her call for security. She'd be there when he came back with a file in his hand, he figured. Head down. Don't even glance up to see where the cameras are. Look for the whiteboard that says Carol Schmidt is inside the room. Her name was scrawled on the outside of a door halfway down the hallway. It took less than a minute. Panos opted for using a pillow, since the machines that were attached to her looked complicated, and the tubes were filled with clear liquid that he figured she could likely do without. It was dark inside the room, although the screens and monitors put out enough ambient light that he could see. One of the machines issued a rhythmic click, click, click. She was older than he thought she'd be and smaller than he'd imagined. Her eyes were closed. Her feet fluttered under the blankets, and she reached out with a small bony hand to try and grasp his wrist, but she couldn't find it. He held the pillow firmly on her face until she went limp, then placed the pillow back under her head when she was gone. He refused to look directly at her gape-mouthed face. Panos stepped back and took a breath that filled his lungs. As he did so, he realized he'd lolled his head back. He quickly lowered it, but not before eyeing the single red light in the top corner of the room that may or may not have been a closed-circuit camera. He put that out of his mind. Streams of sweat poured down his collar. He fumbled the envelope again as he pulled it from his waist, and he dropped it on the linoleum floor, paper scattered, and he shoved them back in the file. In and out, like Kessel had said. Would there be alarms going off now that she was dead? Buzzers? But there was nothing. Maybe some nurse at a different station could see the monitor flatline, but Panos wanted to be out of the hospital by the time someone had the chance to react. "Thanks," he said to Maggie White as he passed by the desk and turned away from her. "You forgot to sign in," she called after him. It wasn't threatening or unfriendly, more like, "You know the drill." But he pushed through the double doors and was outside. The cold actually felt good on his skin for once. He was halfway across the parking lot when he saw that Kessel was no longer there. Panos stopped and said, "Fuck me." He turned and nearly lost his footing on the glazed-over snow, his arms windmilled, but he was able to regain his balance. He could see Maggie White stand up through the double doors. The receptionist was witnessing a nurse in green scrubs jog from left to right in front of her. Obviously the nurse had seen the monitor, Panos thought. He hoped it was one of the life monitor machines and not a closed-circuit video feed. Because the nurse didn't turn her head to see where he'd gone, he guessed it was one of the machines. He looked around. Rollins was dark, cold, and absolutely lifeless. The cold was freezing his face and inching up his cuffs and pant legs. He thought, why would... A pair of headlights flashed on, and Kessel's pickup appeared on the street he'd just crossed. Kessel had left the lot and was waiting outside somewhere on the street while Panos had gone inside. Panos figured the man had probably chosen a different location to observe so he could make a fast lone getaway if Panos was caught inside. His boss leaned over in his seat and pushed open the passenger door.
"Get in," he said.
Panos scrambled in and sat back while Kessel drove away toward I-80. Kessel didn't speed or do anything to attract attention from hidden cops. They caught a break when the few stoplights on Cedar Street were blinking amber due to the late hour. "It's done," Panos said.
"How?"
"Smothered."
"She'd go quietly?"
"I guess." Panos recalled her kicking feet beneath the blanket, and it affected him more deeply in retrospect than it had when he'd been in the room.
"Texas,"
Kessel said.
"You're going to Texas."
"Texas?"
"It's warmer there. You'll do down there what I do up here. It's a promotion and a big one."
Panos thought about it. "So that's my reward?"
"Yes, either there or Iowa."
So Kessel had been talking to the big bosses about him. He wondered if he'd talked to them before he picked him up in Saratoga or while he was inside the hospital. Not that it mattered. Panos had never been to Iowa, and he sometimes got it confused with Idaho or Ohio. But he knew Texas. "Okay," he said.
"Good. But we're not done here. We've got a lot to do before the end of the week."
Panos nodded. He realized that the emotion he'd felt about recalling the final moments of the old woman might be the result of the Percocet wearing off. He fished in his pocket for the remaining two and swallowed them dry. He did it in a furtive moment when Kessel's eyes were on the road.
"There's a couple of snoops down here we need to take care of," Kessel said. "It's high priority and it might get a little hairy."
Panos sat back and waited for the warm bath to wash through him once again. Obviously, Kessel had obtained some new information about these snoops. He hoped he had enough medication to last through whatever came next. Back in the hospital, the emergency nurse approached Maggie White at the desk and sighed, "She's gone." White shook her head. "I'll call the tech." The technical administrator was in charge of securing the room until the morning shift arrived. The body would remain there until the next of kin was notified and the body moved downstairs into the morgue. The nurse said, "Make sure you note that someone forgot to change the patient's name on the whiteboard after we moved Schmidt to the second floor this afternoon." "I'll do that," White said as she checked the patient roster on her monitor. "So it was Mrs. Alvarez who passed?" "Yes, pneumonia in a woman that age." She thought about telling the nurse about Phil with Pfizer, but didn't. He'd only been there for a minute, and he was gone. Chapter 25. Sheriff Neal leaned back heavily in his chair and tossed a folded copy of the Rawlins Daily Times across his desk toward Joe and Nate. Joe didn't open it. He could see the photo of Neil clutching the blow-up sex doll that had first appeared in the Daily Dispatch. It was on the front page.
"We all look like a bunch of damn fools," Neil said. "I look like the biggest fool of all."
Joe said, "Yep."
"You don't have to agree with me. It's going to be a long 9 months until the election."
Nate shifted next to Joe. He was eager to get going. They'd both given their statements, and Nate didn't want to spend another minute in the Carbon County Sheriff's Department office than he had to. Nate, Joe knew, was uncomfortable in these kinds of surroundings.
"What about Les McKnight?" Joe asked. "He's got a busted nose and cheekbone and a concussion," Neil said. "Your daughter clocked him a good one. The hospital said he'll have to stay there a few days before they can release him. Word is he's taking calls from lawyers looking to sue the department. You, and especially your daughter, will probably be safe, though. They'll go after the deep pockets."
"We're going to bargain with him," Neil said. "After all, he did take a couple of shots at us. We might be able to get the suit dropped in exchange for making the attempted assault charges go away."
Joe winced. The negotiations would be messy, and he hoped he could stay out of them. After all, McKnight could claim quite credibly that he was defending his home at night from attackers who'd not identified themselves. And owning a doll wasn't probable cause for an all-out raid.
"I didn't go to morning coffee today," Neil said. "I thought I might end up saying something I'd later regret."
After a beat, he said, "What a mess."
"Yep." "Trouble does seem to follow you around, doesn't it?" Neil asked Joe.
"Seems to."
Joe turned his head. Neil's office was on the second floor of the county building, and his window overlooked a brick building across the street. In a scene that looked like something out of the Depression, a line of men stood outside in the cold, waiting to go inside. They shuffled their feet, and clouds of condensation rose from their mouths. Blue-collar workers, Joe thought. He noted heavy boots, Carhartt coats, and insulated overalls.
"What's going on over there?" he asked.
"Hiring for Buckbrush," Neil said. "The company leased out that empty building a month ago as their headquarters for hiring. We've had guys show up from all over the country trying to get on with that outfit."
Joe heard Nate snort with derision, but ignored him.
"Construction jobs are hard to come by," Neil said. "Some of those guys were laid off for a couple of years. It's going to be a real good thing for the county, that wind farm. Good for the tax base while they build it. After that, the workforce will be fairly small. But we'll deal with that a few years down the road. We're used to boom and bust cycles around here."
"Are there any new leads on Kate's disappearance?" Joe asked. "I mean, good ones?"
"I think I'm out of the Kate business for a while," Neil said with a heavy sigh. "Maybe you should be, too."
Nate stayed in Joe's pickup with a heater running in front of the Carbon County Hospital. Inside, the front desk confirmed to Joe that Joshua Tubner had been admitted the day before for an accidental gunshot wound to the shoulder. His prognosis was good. As he walked back to his truck, Joe realized that in the last 2 days, at least 3 people had been sent to the hospital building behind him. Joshua Tubner, Les McKnight, and the older woman from Saratoga who'd slid off the ice on the road. At this rate, he thought, the hospital would be full and Saratoga empty within a short time. "Trouble does seem to follow you around, doesn't it?" His phone burred as he climbed into the cab. It was another unknown number. Joe punched it up. The connection was filled with static.
"Is this Joe Pickett?"
"It is."
"This is Jeb Pryor?"
It took Joe a few seconds to recall the man.
"Yes." "I'm the owner of the Encampment Lumber Mill. We met the other night at the Wolf."
Gotcha. What can I do for you? I've got something I need to talk to you about. I think you'll have an idea what to do about it.
What is it?
Pryor started to speak when Joe's phone chirped and the call dropped. Cell service was as unreliable in Carbon County as it was in 12 Sleep County. Joe lowered the phone to his lap.
Is Josh Tubner in there?
Nate asked, glaring at the hospital.
Yep.
Want me to go talk with him and get his phone?
Nope.
Maybe he'll recall a little more about that conversation he overheard if he's got a clear head for once.
Nate?
The phone lit up again with unknown number.
Mr. Pryor? Joe asked.
The line was clear this time, so clear he could hear someone breathing.
Joe?
It was a familiar voice.
Yes?
Steve Pollock, I hear you've been asking about me.
Pollock spoke softly, as if he didn't want anyone near him to overhear.
Where are you, Steve?
I'm in Cheyenne, but I'm on my way to Arizona. I find that I can't stand this cold and wind anymore now that I don't have to be out in it.
Joe had the feeling that Pollock was making the call with reluctance and that he might disconnect at any second.
Steve, I think you know I'm in Saratoga. What happened over here?
Shit. Shit happened.
Pollock sounded resigned and morose.
Would you like to talk about it? Joe asked.
I'm not sure.
I'll come to you.
Pollock laughed a bitter laugh.
Yeah. There's no way I'm coming back over there.
I'll come to you in Cheyenne. How long are you going to be there?
Pollock hesitated so long, Joe looked at his phone to make sure they were still live. They were.
I'm leaving early tomorrow, Pollock said. I don't plan to be back.
I'll meet you this afternoon.
Man, I don't know if this is such a good idea after all.
One conversation, Joe said. Game warden to game warden. It'll just be between us. No one at headquarters needs to know we talked.
After another long pause, Pollock said, I can trust you, can I, Joe?
Yep.
Alf's pub on 19th. I'll be at a booth in the back. Leave your recorder in your truck and don't bring anybody else, okay?
Joe agreed, and Pollock killed the call.
Going to Cheyenne? Nate asked.
He nodded.
Bad things happen there.
Joe didn't want to start an argument. He knew Nate's experiences in Cheyenne, his confinement to an off-the-books federal lockup facility for nearly a year, were much different from his own encounters at the state capitol. Nate said,
While you're gone, I'll circle back on a few things and keep my eye on Sheridan.
Are the few things Kate-related or conspiracy theory-related? Joe asked.
Maybe both,
Nate said.
Drop me at the Wolf so I can get out and switch over to my outfit. Yours is too cold inside with this crappy door.
Joe agreed, then. Nate, we really don't want another interrogation that results in another local going to that hospital, if you know what I mean. Nate grunted. Joe told him about the call he'd received from Jeb Pryor. He said, You could save me some time if you went and talked to him. Maybe find out what he was calling about and why he thinks I'd be interested in what he has to say. Give me a call after and we'll figure out our next move.
I'll do it. I've got some business that direction anyway.
Joe nodded. He said, I can't really ask you to do this in any official capacity, because I'm not sure I even have an official capacity anymore. What I do know is I don't have much time left to pretend I do.
I'm taking my fish,
Nate said, after turning in his seat to confirm it was still in the back of the pickup.
If you have to, Joe said.
After checking the Y-Dot app on his phone to find out that I-80 East between Elk Mountain and Laramie was once again closed due to high winds and blowing snow, Joe turned south toward Highway 230 to Laramie and beyond that to Cheyenne. It was the only remaining west-to-east route that was still open. No interstate highway was closed as much as I-80 through southern Wyoming. The locals still complained that the feds should never have built it where they did, and there were still postcards available along the route that read, "I survived the Snow Chi Min Trail." 230 was a lonely two-lane highway with narrow shoulders, surrounded on both sides by endless white, punctuated by distant ranch buildings. Blowing snow had glazed the blacktop shiny with ice, and he slowed down and guided his pickup from milepost to milepost on the far right side of the lane, where there were a few dry patches. Several times he stopped dead while the ground blizzards smoked across the road, and he waited for them to clear up so he could see. As he drove, he was careful not to clip the posts with his exterior mirrors. Oncoming traffic consisted of three vehicles total. The drivers looked over at him furtively as they passed, then resumed their concentration. The route wound up into the heavy timber of the Medicine Bow Forest and dipped into northern Colorado before recrossing the Wyoming border. Thick lodgepole pine trees slowed down the blowing snow from drifting across the highway, although acres of beetle-killed timber did little to help. He saw a herd of brown and beige elk with ice crystals embedded in their thick fur, trudging single file along the burrow pit, with their heads down as if on a forced march to slaughter. In one mountain meadow, he saw the forlorn heads of sage-grouse poking just above the surface of the snowpack, as if looking around for relief from the weather. Snowmobilers raced around on groomed and ungroomed trails near Waikolo Lodge, and he eyed them warily to make sure none of them darted out onto the road in front of him. Wind whistled inside the cab because of the damaged door, and his heater, even on full, couldn't compete with the cold. He turned on the radio to distract himself from the fact that his fingers and toes were getting numb. He caught the middle of the hourly newscast from KOWB out of Laramie. In the case of missing British public relations executive Kate Shelford Lungdon, Governor Allen said in a rare Sunday morning press conference this morning that the state would be redoubling its investigation after purging the effort of what he referred to as incompetent state employees. He quickly turned it off. On good roads, it took a little more than 2 hours to drive from Saratoga to Cheyenne. Joe was approaching hour three as he finally rolled through snow-blasted Laramie. He hoped Pollock's resolve would hold until he could get to Alf's Pub in Cheyenne. The snippet he'd heard on the radio from the governor's press conference had planted a dark seed of defeat in Joe's belly. Despite what Pollock might tell him, if he was there at all, Joe doubted it would get him any closer to unraveling Kate's disappearance. He felt very alone on the highway and in his own head. Although he still had his badge, pickup, and uniform shirt, he wasn't sure he was even acting in an official capacity anymore. His end as a game warden and state employee was approaching fast. They cut off his state gasoline credit card and delete his email account. Rent would stop being paid on his temporary housing in Saddle String. Joe would be adrift, and he'd be dragging his family along for the ride. His mother-in-law, Missy, had finally exacted her revenge, and she'd done it in a sophisticated way from the comfort of her Jackson Hole compound and likely using her most recent husband's fortune. And she'd done it in a way that provided her cover. Joe knew he could probably never prove that she was behind his sacking unless Governor Allen admitted to the quid pro quo, which was highly unlikely. Alan took no responsibility for his bad choices and decisions. He admitted to nothing and never apologized. If something bad happened, it was because of the action of others and their lack of loyalty to him. There was a lot of that going on these days, Joe thought. Missy's involvement in sending Joe into a no-win situation made a perverse kind of sense to him, only because he knew where her motivations lay. With Joe unemployed and adrift, she thought Mary Beth might have to turn back to her for financial assistance and possibly even housing. Library directors in small towns didn't make much money, and mortgages and college tuition didn't pay for themselves. Plus, he thought, Missy could claim that she'd been right about Joe all along. In the end, he couldn't provide for his family. Mary Beth was too smart to fall for that, and she was tougher than Missy ever gave her credit for. Still, though, he never should have agreed to be Alan's range rider, he thought, even though he hadn't seen it as a choice at the time. Alan wasn't Rulon and never would be. Rulon had always maintained plausible deniability when sending Joe out on an assignment in case he screwed it up, but Rulon never threw him under the bus when things went pear-shaped. Rulon's motivations had come from a lofty place, even if they were sometimes misguided. Politicians like Alan, with a fake biography and a recent pasted-on ideology, came from a different place altogether. Joe was conflicted. He no longer wanted to be on Alan's team, even if he hadn't been fired, but at the same time he couldn't simply walk away from Kate's disappearance without knowing what had happened to her. Kate Shelford Longdon was a real person made up of flesh and blood. What if she were Mary Beth, or one of his own daughters? Joe parked his pickup at the backside of Alf's pub and package liquor so it couldn't be seen from the street. Green game and fish pickups were easily identifiable, especially in the capital city where the headquarters was located. He didn't want Director LGD or any of her toadies seeing the vehicle parked in the lot of a bar in the middle of the afternoon and stopping to roust him. He paused after entering, and the door wheezed closed behind him. It took a moment for his eyes to adjust from the bright white ocean of snow outside to the darkness of the bar. Neon beer signs, television monitors, a longhorn bull skull above the bar, all emerged from the gloom. And there in the back, seated behind a small table in a brown faux leather chair, was Steve Pollock. Pollock was out of uniform and wearing a thick University of Wyoming hoodie and jeans. Next to him was a wide-shouldered man in a jacket and tie. He looked nervous. Joe walked up and tipped the brim of his hat to them. "I thought it was just going to be us," Joe said to Pollock. "Joe, meet Michael Williams of DCI." Joe shook his hand and sat down. Pollock said, "We thought we'd all have plenty to talk about, since the three of us have all been disappeared by the governor." Chapter 26. On his way south from Saratoga to the Encampment Lumber Mill, Nate took a once familiar turnoff from the highway. It was a ranch access road a mile past the frozen North Platte River. He noted there was already a set of tire tracks in the snow ahead of him. Dr. Kurt and Laura Buchholz had sheltered him 2 years before when he'd been hiding out from federal charges. The ranchers had allowed him and Liv Brannan to hide out in a small log cabin near the river and stay off the grid. They'd allowed it even though the two of them were patriotic and law-abiding people who could have been arrested for harboring a fugitive. The feds had eventually located him on the ranch, and they'd offered him a devil's bargain. Work with them on a secret mission in Wyoming's Red Desert, or be prosecuted. Additionally, the agents had threatened Liv and the Buchholz couple with arrest. He jumped at the deal because he didn't have a choice. But he'd never really said goodbye to the ranch couple or properly thanked them for all they'd done for him and Liv. When he made the turn through the Stark River cottonwoods, he didn't expect to find the ranch house empty and all the vehicles and ranch equipment gone, including the stock trailers, or the single new model company pickup backed up to the front door of the ranch house with a pile of clothing, furniture, and artwork in the back. He recognized the possessions as having belonged to the Buchholzes. He narrowed his eyes and felt a tremor of rage roll down his back. Nate drove his SUV up to the grill of the company truck so the bumpers were nose to nose, and he leapt outside without turning off the motor. His right hand was on the grip of his .454 inside his coat. A man came out of the house with an armful of clothing, but didn't see him standing there because the pile blocked his vision. He tossed the items into the bed of the truck. Only when he heard the snick-snick of Nate's weapon being cocked did he look up quizzically. He was a young man, early 20s. He wore a stocking cap pulled down over his ears, and he had a long, bushy, ZZ Top-style reddish beard sequined with ice. He looked to Nate like what he was, an employee of Buckbrush Power, the company name on the outside of his jacket, and the logo on the door of the pickup confirmed it.
"Who are you, and what are you doing?"